And welcome to this media call to discuss the results of a new ABI-funded study of the impact of the 2005 bankruptcy amendments on the cost to consumer debtors. I'm Sam Giordano, Executive Director of the American Bankruptcy Institute. This afternoon, we have the study reporter and principal investigator, Lois Lupica, here to discuss her findings and answer questions. Lois is the Maine Foundation Professor of Law at the University of Maine School of Law. She is also a past resident scholar of the American Bankruptcy Institute. Her comprehensive study quantifies the additional costs and expenses incurred by consumer debtors having to comply with the terms of the major change to the bankruptcy law in 2005, the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act, or BAPSEPA. Her new report follows a pilot study also funded by ABI and completed in 2009. Professor Lupica will make a presentation and then answer your questions. Professor Lupica, please begin.
Okay, thank you, Sam, and thank you all for joining us. Let me just offer some brief background to the study before I launch into some of the findings. As Sam noted, and as you all likely know, the 2005 amendments to the code altered the bankruptcy system in many large and small ways. And prior to BAPSEPA's enactment, there was much speculation and commentary about how the amendments would affect the operation of the system. And until now, there hasn't been a comprehensive national study on the impact of BAPSEPA on the bankruptcy system's operation, on its professionals, and ultimately on its system users. And this study provides data that does just that. And so, as Sam noted, the primary objective of the study is to identify and monetize the cost of access to the consumer bankruptcy system through the analysis of both quantitative and qualitative data. And this data was gathered from court files. We examined over 11,000 consumer bankruptcy filings, and from professionals working within the bankruptcy system. And we examined both the Chapter 13 consumer bankruptcy system as well as the Chapter 7 system. We gathered data on dismissed cases with respect to Chapter 13 filings and on cases that went to discharge, and have data, which is all set forth in the final report, at the national, state, and district levels. So let me briefly offer you some of the highlights with respect to the specific findings. With respect to Chapter 13 cases that have gone to discharge, that resulted in the debtor receiving a discharge, we found that pre-BAPSEPA relative to post-BAPSEPA, there was a 27% increase in what we defined as total direct access costs. Total direct access costs include attorney's fees, filing fees, and other fees associated with a consumer accessing the system, which include the credit counseling and debtor education courses. The largest component of total direct access costs are attorney's fees, and we found that attorney's fees increased relative to pre-BAPSEPA filings 24%. As I noted, we also found, and that's a national aggregate number, so we examined attorney's fees in discharge Chapter 13 cases by circuit, by state, and by district. And I'm just going to review some of the state findings. We found that attorney's fees ranged at the mean from approximately $1,200 to $3,711, with the highest fees found in the state of Maine and the lowest fees found in Wisconsin. And there are appendices to the final report which set forth every circuit, every state, and every district specific number at the average. We compared those numbers to those pre-BAPSEPA numbers to attorney's fees charged during the post-BAPSEPA period, and again, the state of Maine had the highest fees at $4,950, and the lowest fees were found in North Dakota at approximately $1,500. We also looked at the percentage difference, which jurisdictions had the highest percentage change and lowest percentage change. We found the range was between 1% in Massachusetts to 115% increase, and that was in the state of Idaho. With respect to Chapter 7 cases, we examined both asset cases and no asset cases. Obviously, there are far more no asset cases than asset cases. We found that attorney's fees in discharge Chapter 7 no asset cases increased 48% from the pre-BAPSIPA to the post-BAPSIPA period. The highest fees pre-BAPSIPA were found in Alaska and the lowest in Washington State. Post-BAPSIPA, the highest fees were found in Arizona and the lowest in Idaho. And the most significant difference was found in the state of Virginia. We also found that there was the distributions to unsecured creditors post-BAPSIPA were not statistically significantly higher post-BAPSIPA than they were pre-BAPSIPA. We actually found slightly lower numbers, but the difference was not statistically significant. So that's a brief overview of the quantitative data. And as I said, in the final report, which is on the ABI website, there's a lot more information, both with respect to dismissed cases, asset Chapter 7 cases, and broken down by jurisdiction. So depending upon the geographic area you're focused on, you can research that. The other aspect of the study was a qualitative analysis of data gathered from professionals working in the system. And the professionals that we interviewed and conducted focus group interviews with included debtors' attorneys, bankruptcy judges, U.S. trustees, panel trustees, and standing trustees. And we used, as I noted, surveys, focus groups, and one-on-one interviewed. And from these interviews, we were able to see the system, the consumer bankruptcy system, as it is actually experienced by professionals on the front line. And we found that a number of things that were both surprising and confirming. One of the things we found was that the period of time between when a debtor initially consults a professional, an attorney, and when the debtor ultimately decides to file, if they decide to file, can take not only months but multiple visits to attorneys. And what goes on during the period of time from the initial consultation until the filing involves everything from the individual debtor's acclimating him or herself to the decision to file while they are gathering the required documentation. And once the documentation is in fact gathered and the debtor is has made the ultimate decision to file, what typically happens is that a petition is prepared. But what was also reported by attorneys and trustees is that due to the nature of the system and the difficulty of gathering the specifics of the needed documentation, oftentimes the petition and the schedules have to be prepared multiple times. And that affects both the experience of the debtor in terms of the emotional anguish and the period of time they have to wait to even begin to enter the system and ultimately receive the needed remedy, but it also affects the cost of the system. We look specifically at costs in both Chapter 7 and Chapter 13. With respect to Chapter 7, we found that the attorney fee is typically paid up front because under the law, any agreement to pay a fee post-petition is unenforceable. But what that means is that often the putative debtor has to save up in order to file for bankruptcy. We found that attorney's fees in Chapter 7 are strongly influenced by market forces, and that there is downward pressure on fees due to market competition. But notwithstanding the downward pressure, we also found a dramatic increase in fees. We also examined panel trustees and their role in the system. And what we found were that in Chapter 7 cases, it takes a panel trustee two to three more hours to administer a case. And that trustees found was attributable to continuances for debtors' failure to produce documents. We also noted that the fee for no-asset panel trustee cases is $60 and has been since the mid-90s, and that was reported to be a considerable hardship, recognizing the number of hours a panel trustee puts into a no-asset cases. And we also found that there was a pretty dramatic impact of informa pauperis cases, which are cases where the filing fee for debtors are waived, but what it also means is that the panel trustee receives no fee in such a case. With respect to Chapter 13 cases, we found a number of factors influenced not only what an attorney was paid, but how an attorney was paid. And the combination of how and the circumstances of payment have a direct substantive effect upon the debtor and its experience with the system and even initial decision-making as well as outcome. We identified three major influences on fees in Chapter 13 cases: individual debtors' firm practices, local custom, which was a very strong determinant, as well as local rules. And we found a great deal of variation from jurisdiction to jurisdiction with respect to local rules and local customs. We found that there are a number of ways Chapter 13 fees are structured, again, depending upon jurisdiction, sometimes from court to court, and certainly variation by state, by region. In many jurisdictions, there is what is known as a presumptively reasonable fee, or in other jurisdictions known as a no-look fee. And in some jurisdictions, that is a fee that, if charged, will not be reviewed by the court and is a cradle-to-grave fee. So the attorney is responsible for representation given that singular fee for the entire Chapter 13 process, which can go on for as long as 5 years. In yet other jurisdictions, there are opportunities for lawyers to submit a fee application for additional fees if either unexpected events transpire, there are motions filed that either by the debtor or the debtor has to defend. In some jurisdictions, there is a menu of fee. So, for example, if there is a motion for relief from stay filed, the attorney to address that is paid a set amount. In others, an attorney files an hourly fee, and the presumptively reasonable fee is simply a starting point. And this is all to say that the experience on the part of debtors' counsel in representing debtors in Chapter 13 varies dramatically, again, depending upon the state, the region, the jurisdiction, and often the court. And what that also means is that the experience of the debtor in the consumer bankruptcy system is not a uniform experience at all. We looked at the particular tasks that are included in a presumptively reasonable fee to see exactly what that presumptively reasonable fee means. And we found that with respect to every jurisdiction that has a presumptively reasonable fee, they all include the following tasks: an initial meeting to explain the process to debtors, advice to debtors with respect to their obligations and duties under the code, the requirement of gathering documents required under Section 521 of the code, the attorney preparing the plan and the petition, the attorney attending the 341 meeting, any and all post-341 meeting communications, and then finally attendance at confirmation hearings. So in some jurisdictions, those are the tasks that the presumptively reasonable fee includes, and any other activities tasks associated with debtor representation, the lawyer is paid an additional amount. But in other jurisdictions, in addition to all of those tasks, under the presumptively reasonable fee, the lawyer is responsible for the filing, preparing any motions required to protect client interests, preparation and filing of responses to motions, including motions for relief from stay, motions for dismissal, motions to modify plans, and any and all contested matters. In yet other jurisdictions, in addition to all of those tasks, included in the presumptively reasonable fee are circumstances where a debtor has to represent a debtor in adversary proceedings, either as plaintiff or defendant, representation of a debtor where the court orders some kind of fee shifting, and representation of a debtor where the first hearing is more than 120 days following confirmation. We also found that notwithstanding the idea of a presumptively reasonable fee as a threshold fee, there were a number of jurisdictions, I believe somewhat over 20, where the fee at the mean is lower than the presumptively reasonable fee, which means lawyers are not even charging the minimum fee. And when asked why that would be the case or in what circumstances that would be the case, the answers we got back included, well, if there's a particularly sympathetic client, if the debtor can't afford the presumptively reasonable fee, if the Chapter 13 is filed in order to pay attorney's fees with the affirmative intention to convert to a Chapter 7, or if the Chapter 13 case is, in fact, a disguised Chapter 7, meaning that certain income is not counted in a Chapter 13, but it is, in fact, counted in a Chapter 7. So we also found, and I'm coming to the end of this, but I just want to be clear about the some of the distinctions in fees are affected by the lawyer and or the firm business policies and practices, what is required by the presiding judge, the interpretation of the bankruptcy code in a particular jurisdiction, and there is variation, the Chapter 13 trustees' policies, practices, and interpretations, the attorney's prediction about the case's feasibility, the general market forces for legal services, and local custom and practice. So I'm going to just conclude with the following thoughts. And in going through the analysis of literally thousands of transcripts of interviews and open-ended survey responses, we found a number of things: that there are a a dearth of resources available to pay for debtor representation in an increasingly complex system. And yet, at the same time, there's a greater need for debtors to be represented because the system is, in many ways and in many instances, too complex for a debtor to successfully navigate without counsel. There are fewer, simpler cases, and yet there is the clash of BAPSIPA's the timing of BAPSIPA's enactment and the economic conditions that debtors have experienced over the past 5 years or so. There's a greater need on the part of attorneys for a nuanced understanding of the system, a recognition that there is a distinction between how the system works in theory and how it works in practice. The consumer bankruptcy system is considerably less tolerant of mistakes, but it's complexity means that there are more opportunities to make errors. And so that leads to, on the part of attorneys, the temptation to cut corners to minimize the time spent on each case or price consumers out of represented access to the system. And we found that the system, as it's currently constituted, is fighting against best practices in terms of quality of practice, but we also found that highly skilled consumer bankruptcy attorneys are indispensable to accessibility of the system. So now I would be happy to answer any specific or general questions that any of you have.
Thank you. And the question and answer session will be conducted electronically today. If you do have a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. Once again, please press star 1 at this time if you have a question.
Lois, while we're waiting for the first question, can I get you to talk about why you think the costs went up? Is it the matter of complexity of the new law? And if so, is there some particular provision within the group of amendments that you found to be the most the biggest factor?
Well, it's not one thing. There's not one thing we can point to say this is why the cost went up. It's a situation of a thousand paper cuts has been described to me. There is so much more documentation required of debtors, but what there also is that the process just becomes that much more lengthy given the type of documentation that has to be gathered. And an inflexible 6 months of pay advices. Well, debtors without W-2 wages don't necessarily have or don't have pay advices, and often debtors, even if they do have regular W-2 wages, aren't able to put their hands on them. And so if it takes an additional month to come up with that documentation, then the schedules have to be redone. And so what was described to me is a series of fits and starts and much more attorney time, which translates into higher fees. If you're looking for the finger pointed at one particular element, people either said all of it, the entire system, because of the just general complexity and the issue of pay advices, people pointed to quite frequently.
And does that all emanate from the means testing requirement?
It's all related. It's documentation required to substantiate the means testing. Interestingly, it wasn't the means testing itself. I think there was an awful lot of concern prior to 2005 and just after that would be an enormous burden. Well, it hasn't turned out to be itself, but it's part of a considerably more complex process. No doubt, and while debtors still try from time to time to represent themselves in Chapter 13 cases. Most of the pro se representation is in Chapter 7, and I think the means testing did affect debtors who have tried pre-BAFSEPA or would try post-BAFSEPA to represent themselves in Chapter 13, but when represented by an attorney, it wasn't the means testing itself. It's the process that surrounds the whole means testing.
And once again, if you do have a question at this time, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone.
Lois, maybe another question. Was it the other finding that struck me as significant, given the arguments that were made by proponents in the credit industry and within Congress for BAFSEPA, was it surprising that returns to unsecured creditors did not increase?
It didn't surprise me. When a debtor enters bankruptcy, it becomes, in essence, a zero-sum game. There's only so much money to go around in terms of administration of the bankruptcy case and repayment of creditors. And it makes sense that if more of a debtor's finite resources are going to pay administrative costs, including attorney's fees, including the credit counseling and debtor education fees, there's going to be less left for in the residual estate for unsecured creditors. And we found, as I said, a slight decline at the mean in distribution to unsecured creditors, but the decline was not statistically significant. So I think that what we can say from a statistical perspective is that there was no statistically significant change. I actually thought it might be less than it was, but this is an issue that I plan to study further. But in the first regression modeling that we did, we found no statistically significant change.
Thank you.
And we have no one in our queue at this time. I would, however, like to give everyone another opportunity. Please press star 1 if you have a question.
Let me try one more question, Lois, while we're waiting. If that wasn't surprising, what was surprising in terms of the outcomes as you were writing the report after analyzing all of the data?
I think the most surprising thing to me was how the professionals in the system, from debtors' counsel to trustees to the U.S. trustee system to judges, all were working so hard to make the system provide the relief that debtors, particularly in this economy, need, and were uniformly frustrated that the system was essentially fighting that kind of relief. The consumer bankruptcy system was not amended to make it easier to use, and from attorneys to judges to trustees, there was a consistent recognition that to the extent that there was a change that made the system more difficult, but ultimately provided a benefit, there was no problem with that. There was no concern about that. What was of concern to our survey subjects were requirements that didn't seem to provide any benefit to the debtors, any benefit to the system, but were essentially fighting the system. There was a real sense that it was in many ways unnecessarily harder and unnecessarily more expensive to help a consumer debtor navigate through the system. and it was harder to practice law in a professional and professionally responsible way under this system, given that there is a finite pool of resources to compensate the professionals in the system. I think that the degree of frustration coupled with the degree of commitment and compassion to a fair system was surprising to me.
And we have no questions in our queue.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Lois, for your time. And we thank those on the call for joining us. We will post a full audio of the exchange on our website at www.abi.org. Thank you, Lois, and thanks all for joining us.